Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the second in our Chancellor's Reflect series. And as you'll see, we have Geoffrey Howard, who's a long-standing friend of the schools, to speak to us this evening.
You're the wrong couple.
Now, I must begin with a brief personal reminiscence, because for a while I did work for Geoffrey, as indeed I work for four of the five chancellors who are reflecting. And in May 1979, when Margaret Thatcher's government was elected and Geoffrey came into the Treasury as Chancellor, I at the time was working in what was called the Defence and Materiel section of the Treasury, and like many Treasury officials, was of course somewhat apprehensive about what this change of regime would mean. And what I did, which I imagine many of you would have done in my position, was to leave the country. But that was, I should hasten to point out, it was nothing personal, Geoffrey. It was that I was actually due to go off by sent by the Treasury to Stanford for a year. And then when I came back from Stanford in the September of 1980, my job was to be what was grandly called Principal Monetary Policy in a division that was called Home Finance at the time. And of course, that was the period which has been perhaps somewhat unkindly described since as the pseudo-monetarist period of economic policy, when we had interest rates of, I think, 17% as I arrived in the Treasury in order to squeeze out a rather unfortunate inflationary bubble which had emerged. So I was in the engine room of the Treasury, well below the salt. I was the person who struggled to find a seat at the end of the table, sometimes taking minutes of the Chancellor's meetings, but was therefore in the Treasury for most of Geoffrey's Chancellorship. So for me, it's particularly interesting to have him here this evening to reflect on that time. It is sort of all my yesterday, as it is for some, but by no means for all of you, and I'm greatly looking forward to his reflections this evening. Geoffrey particularly asked me to let him explain the title, which I will do. Geoffrey, welcome.
Thank you. Well, I must say it's a great honour to have been invited not just once but twice in two successive years to appear as an exhibit in the school's antique roadshow. And I must also say that this second occasion is much more challenging than the first time as Foreign Secretary, because of the four cabinet posts I was lucky enough to hold, the position of the Chancellor of the Exchequer is the one in which one is least likely to be loved. It's also a very difficult one. And when Dennis Healy, whom I'm sorry not to have heard last week, but I'm sure he entertained you well, when he rang to congratulate me on my appointment as his successor, and he was the first person to do so, I may say, which is characteristic of his generosity, he immediately said, "Welcome, Geoffrey, to the bed of nails." And rightly so, because it was the Treasury where I began to appreciate most sharply a very forceful insight of the late Edmund Dell, who was Dennis's Paymaster General, when he said, and I quote, "For anyone afraid that ignorance renders him ineligible for responsibility, politics is not the right profession." And yet, as I became more familiar with the task of managing the nation's economic affairs, the more I came to wonder whether the soundness of my judgment was necessarily or even at all dependent upon the breadth and quality of my economic literacy. Hence the disrespectful tone of the title to which the chairman has referred. For the benefit of younger members, since it's now almost 25 years ago, I'll explain a little about that. The 364 economists in question, and I suspect that they're not unrepresented in this audience here. I think that your immediate predecessor as director of the school was one of those who signed the letter. There are those who asserted in a very terse letter to the Times of March the 30th, 1981, just 2 weeks after my third budget. I quote, "There is no basis in economic theory or supporting evidence for the government's present policies." They couldn't have stated the choice more starkly. "The time has come," they said, "to reject monetarist policies and by necessary implication to revert to something like the preceding policy mix." Because their prescription, for which one looked enthusiastically, was no more specific, and again I quote, "than to consider urgently which alternative," 364 alternatives, "which alternative offers the best hope of sustained economic recovery." Their timing could hardly have been less appropriate, because it was in that quarter that the fall in national output came to an end, and over the next 8 years, real GDP grew by an average of 3.2% per annum, which I suppose is what they'd call sustained economic recovery. And by the end of my last year in the Treasury, inflation was down to 3.7%, lower than at any time since 1968. No wonder I've bored so many people with my observation that an economist is a man who knows 364 ways of making love, but who doesn't know any women. The ideological flavour of that mass letter had, however, reminded me of a formidably expert seminar which I had addressed at our Washington embassy only 6 months before. And towards the end of that, J.K. Galbraith, who was one of the daunting characters present, rose to his enormous height and ironically urged me to continue my monetarist experiment until Milton Friedman's theories had been tested to destruction. The 364 letter writers had really presented the choice in similarly challenging terms. Happily, I've never myself been temperamentally attracted by ideological absolutism, and least of all in the field of economic policy. When I arrived at the Treasury, as Edmund Dill pointed out in his book, quote, "Howe did not possess the technical qualifications to choose between the different measures and the different forms of control offered to him." But Edmund was also kind enough to add, and shrewd enough, "Probably no one had the necessary qualifications, even among those claiming to be expert in the field." On the other hand, I was able to draw upon my experience of having grappled with the diversity of conflicting expert evidence during 20 years of very diverse practice at the bar. And my resulting, quote, "loyally scepticism," which Edmund Dill also noted, was certainly not diminished by my experience of and insight into the dismal science over the previous quarter of a century of active political engagement with economic issues. My tone so far, I'm afraid, Chairman, must have sounded a shade unfriendly towards economists. Let me try to correct the balance. I certainly don't seek to argue that economists are uniquely unqualified to determine, or at least to influence, the shape of government economic policy. Still less do I suggest that lawyers are better qualified to do so. But I do contend, in relation to expert matters of every kind, that there is an indispensable role which only politicians can play. Two phrases illustrate this. One was A.J. Balfour's dictum, also often echoed by Alec Douglas Hume, "Democracy is government by explanation." And second, a much shorter one, a chapter heading from a book by C.H. Sisson, the distinguished civil servant. Again, I quote, "The politician as intruder." A well-governed society needs people of that disposition whose role it is to intrude among the experts of all kinds, to evaluate their thinking and advice, to evolve the practical implications, not least to explain them to people at large, so that they may understand the consequences and often participate in their implementation. Those who aspire to this role, and we intruders don't always recognise ourselves, almost inevitably find themselves drawn, indeed driven, towards problems which require some insight into economics. And so it was in my 25 years before I reached the Treasury. I wrote pamphlets about the abolition of rent control, about the transformation of the Welsh economy. I wrote two tracts about the welfare state, one of which attracted a comment from Nicholas Timmins in his book about the Four Giants, that I had summed up much of what was to be the radical rights agenda throughout the 1980s. And at the end, I served as Solicitor General in the Heath government and played a substantial part in preparing the Industrial Relations Bill and the European Communities Act and enacting them both. It was only then, when I became Minister for Consumer Affairs in the Heath government in 72, that I was first exposed directly to expert guidance of the kind offered to ministers. Although I was described as Minister for Consumer Affairs, Ted Heath, from the moment of my appointment, insisted on referring to me as the Minister for Keeping Down Prices, for such in his eyes I was expected to be. There was a very special irony about that, because our prices and incomes policy, stage one, the incomes and policy freeze, was introduced on the very day of my joining the Cabinet. And I hadn't been consulted about it for one word, but there I was. It was a massive U-turn, but one which took almost nobody by surprise, because pay settlements at that time were once again roaring ahead. The miners had just secured a 27% award earlier in the year. So that a move towards a prices and incomes freeze had been virtually demanded by the Tory Party conference a few weeks before. It was, of course, the fourth attempt of its kind. Stafford Cripps, Selwyn Lloyd and George Brown had all been this way before. But characteristically, under Ted Heath's leadership, our ill-fated attempt was even more absolutist than before. Throughout, I was one of the small group of ministers, Prime Minister, Chancellor, Employment Secretary, and Minister for Keeping Down Prices, who spent almost every weekend, and as it seems, almost every day, either at Chequers or at Number 10, closeted either with the TUC or the CBI or both, or just with ourselves. And on the 4th of March, 1974, it all ended in tears, and Harold Wilson was back in Downing Street. I certainly don't propose to review the history of the next 5 years, for which Dennis Healey has bravely accepted responsibility. But what I want to do is to ask you to look instead at the difference, at the longer period, between my first coming into government with Ted Heath in June 1970, and my second arrival with Margaret Thatcher in May 1979. How had our minds moved during that decade? How, at least, had my own thinking evolved? How did the events of those 9 years help to shape the policies which later earned the sobriquet of Thatcherism? If you're to understand the answer to those questions, you must understand the atmosphere which surrounded our arrival in office in 1979. The most important feature was indisputable. Nobody by then could any longer doubt that Britain, and above all our economy, was in deep, deep trouble. For the second or even a third time, the government had been driven from office by industrial strife. The turmoil of the three-day week had been more than matched by the winter of discontent. Unemployment and inflation were both frighteningly high and rising. Our relative decline was becoming absolute. Most important of all, the perception was becoming better and better understood at home and abroad. Sir Nicholas Henderson's well-leaked Paris dispatch brutally and correctly described our country as the sick man of Europe. The soon-to-depart Prime Minister, Jim Callaghan, had shrewdly identified these truths when he told his then special advisor, Bernard Donoghue, I quote, "There are times, perhaps once every 30 years, when there is a change in politics, a shift in what the public wants. I suspect that there is now such a sea change. All this was destined to give our government a significant advantage when we came in, for there were at last some spreading seeds of understanding of the need for a new beginning, with the prospect of a long haul ahead. My first budget had to and did signal just that, by offering a clear idea of our objectives and methods, and a strong political will to succeed. Margaret Thatcher's tenacity was to be crucial in that respect. We had to signal also that there was to be a substantial change in approach, to signal, if you like, that the US cavalry had arrived. Not today's US cavalry, but the traditional US cavalry. Hence, perhaps, the impression which I gained on arrival in the Treasury, and which you, Chairman, might confirm or deny, that the then Permanent Secretary, Sir Douglas Wass, was sceptically eager, along with most of his colleagues, to join in a genuinely fresh and determined onslaught on the British disease with which they had grappled in vain for so long. And they weren't to be disappointed by the freshness of our approach. Gradually, I believe, they came to appreciate and to share with a wider audience the view that few, if any, of our proposals had emerged without a good deal of thought. Jim Callaghan had rightly identified the 30-year timescale for fundamental change. Because the great majority of those of us who came to form the core of Margaret Thatcher's cabinet had cut our political teeth, as I had done, way back in the general elections of 1950 and 51, at the end of the Attlee Revolution. The next two decades witnessed the acceptance of many of the virtues of that period, but beneath the apparent consensus of Butskillism, from which the Wilson governments hadn't dramatically departed, people were beginning to perceive its neglected or developing defects. Hence, at the risk of some unseemly vanity, and just to illustrate many others, my own 1960s essay, the one which Nicholas Timmins had identified, was a product of that. Hence, too, of far greater significance, the whole tone and content of the Heath Manifesto for the 1970 election. Selsdon Mann, the notional, mythical author of that document, did indeed blaze a trail that was eventually to play a part in shaping the last quarter of the 20th century, but not, alas, in the Heath decade itself. Yet those were the years which started to define many of the crucial changes that were to come. And I was lucky enough to be amongst those who were either in the front row of the stalls or on stage throughout that formative period. I think we had four fundamentally important perceptions. First and foremost, and eventually our overriding realization, was that inflation on anything like the scale that was becoming endemic was entirely incompatible with the creation or preservation of a stable, fair, and efficient society. It was, I think, hard for those of us whose childhood and early world had been one of virtually stable prices to abandon that premise. Hence the determination of successive governments to give priority to that objective. Second, the perception that economic flexibility, efficiency, indeed success, were being stifled by over-regulation and all too often by the consequences of public ownership. Harold Wilson's bonfire of controls when he was president of the Board of Trade in the Attlee government was only the first of many indecisive infernos of that kind. The whole apparatus of price, income, dividend and exchange control was to become the most intrusive example of continuing failure in our time. Third was the long neglected need for dramatic change in the structure of our tax system, above all for a decisive switch from direct to indirect taxation. It's almost impossible now to recall, even to believe, the penal top income tax rates of that era, higher than anywhere in the world except Albania. Change on that front was to be one of the most explicit features of my first budget. Finally, and most important, was the eventual acceptance of the case for far-reaching reform of the labour markets. It had taken decades for that view to prevail, not least because the giant's strength of trade union bargaining power hadn't been fully realised or exploited until some years after it had been refurbished by the Trades Disputes Act of 1946. The impact of that imbalance was significantly increased, moreover, in cases where a monopoly union found itself engaged in what was often a potentially malign partnership with a state-owned monopoly employer. This was, of course, much more often the case after the nationalisation programme of the Attlee government. Remarkably, the issue had only really been admitted to the respectable political agenda during the first Wilson government. Lord Donovan's Royal Commission was appointed in April 1965. The Battle of Downing Street, described in Peter Jenkins' book of that name, took place only after the Prime Minister had called in vain upon Hughy Scanlon, the General Secretary of the AEU as it then was, to take your tanks off my lawn, Hughy. Then came Barbara Castle's courageous 1968 White Paper, In Place of Strife, which foreshadowed many of the provisions of our 1971 Industrial Relations Act. These were in large part repealed by Michael Foot in 1974. So that by 1979, there was an increasingly crying need for reform of the labour market. It was an idea whose time had certainly come. The winter of discontent had made sure of that. Now, those four topics dominated the whole of my 4 years as Shadow Chancellor. They were on the agenda, which we had good reason to believe we should soon be called upon to implement on arriving in office. Labour had come to office with an overall majority of only three, soon whittled away by election defeats. Politically, they were dependent on the Liberal Party, and economically dependent, after the 1976 sterling crisis, upon the IMF. It was at that year's Labour conference, 1976, that Jim Callaghan bluntly dismissed the notion of increasing employment by spending your way out of a recession. It was, he said, and you must be bored to distraction by the quotation, an option that no longer exists, and insofar as it ever did exist, only worked on each occasion by injecting bigger doses of inflation into the economy, followed by higher levels of unemployment as the next step. Words often attributed to Sir Peter Jay, but spoken nonetheless by the Prime Minister. And for the remainder of their time in office, Labour was committed to the achievement of quantified monetary targets. It cannot be stated too often that by the time the Thatcher government came into office, that was already an established part of British economic policy. Labour had made a virtue out of IMF necessity. We went on to make it a necessity out of Labour's reluctant virtue. That was the background to the work which I chaired in the Conservative Party's Economic Reconstruction Group, which led to the production of our 1977 policy document, The Right Approach to the Economy. That had been hammered out between a wide group of people, including Keith Joseph, Jim Pryor, myself, and Angus Moore, our editor. And I had taken pains to ensure the exclusion from our thinking of what I called theological absolutes. We did propose, and it's not without interest, we in office secured a number of moves towards a more independent role for the Bank of England. The governor became most valuably a member of NEDI, was in regular public contact for the Treasury and Civil Service Select Committee, only one of a number of such bodies that came into existence at that time. It was the beginning of a process which was eventually to take decisions about interest rates out of number 10 Downing Street, where they certainly ought not to be, via the Ken and Eddie show to the Monetary Policy Committee. Our most anxious discussions concerned the search for an enduring way out of formal incomes policy. One or two theologians confidently argued that everything would fall into place in response to clearly managed monetary restraint. I had no such belief in automaticity. We had to persuade actors on the labour market that it was for them to understand and respect the constraints on their bargaining position. Repeatedly, I stressed our commitment not to quote free, which means potentially reckless, not to free collective bargaining, but to responsible collective bargaining, free from government intervention. It was that we were eventually able to achieve. Probably the largest obstacle was our Shadow Cabinet's pre-election decision, against my strong advice and Margaret's slightly less robust instinct, to honour the recommendations of the so-called Clegg Commission on Public Sector Pay, which had just been set up by our predecessors. Alongside the process of policy formulation, we had also to address the problems of persuading the electorate. And by good fortune, we had available, at least to the inner shadow cabinet, of a resource whose existence has often been overlooked, but whose significance was long-term. I have in mind the so-called Stepping Stones project, which was led by John Hoskins, a successful IT entrepreneur who had now become able, because of his independence, to join us in tackling the economic mess. And he describes the story very fully in his own memoirs. He had, in fact, tried to sell his analysis to other political parties, eventually found an eager taker in Keith Joseph, and once blessed by Margaret Thatcher, Hoskins' joint overseers were Keith and myself. His first report reached us in November 1977. To a large extent, it was a fortification of thinking that we'd been engaged in for a number of years. Its special value was to put those thoughts into a deeper and longer perspective. The central thesis was that the necessary sea changes in Britain's political economy would require much more than a Tory landslide to carry them through. Our strategy had to include long-term plans for the avoidance or removal of political obstacles to its implementation. The greatest of these was inevitably the negative sense of the trade unions. To compete with Labour in seeking coexistence with an unchanged union movement would ensure continued economic decline. Skillfully handled, however, the rising tide of public feeling could transform the unions from the Labour Party's secret weapon into their major liability. This way, the fear, on our part as much as anybody else's, of union-Tory conflict could be laid to rest. That essential insight was powerfully validated by the winter of discontent. Equally crucial was the perception that there were plenty of other things we had to do as well. Most important was the recognition that this was a strategy that certainly should not be launched in any kind of blitzkrieg, but had to be followed discreetly and unfolded gradually, step by step. In that context, Margaret Thatcher's initial enthusiasm was, to the surprise of many people, sensibly tempered by her instinct for caution. That was reflected in our 1979 manifesto. Our collective judgment was thereafter shaped by an uneasy but mercifully developing balance between radicals like Margaret, Keith, myself, and Norman Tebbit, an unusual alliance, and on the other hand, people like Willie Whitelaw, Quinton Hailsham, and Jim Prower. Events conspired to bring hearts and heads together. The basic analysis was thus able to offer guidance for years ahead as reckless union leadership continued, astonishingly, to make our case, at least until the conclusion of the miners' strike of 1984-5. But I've got ahead of myself. Let me come back to the prospect facing us on the 3rd of May 1979. Clearly, my budget was going to shape expectations for a long time ahead. First, the end of pay, price and dividend control, to a large extent, the funeral of a regime that had already collapsed. Second, most heralded signal of all, a dramatic shift in the shape of our tax burden, replacing two rates of VAT with one at 15%, and thus making room for matching reductions in all income tax rates. The top rates came down by 23% to a level that was astonishingly low then, although much higher than that which we have today. And taken together, those changes much matched the most applauded line in virtually every speech I'd made during 4 years of opposition. Pay as you spend makes far more sense than pay as you earn. The third signal was to rein back the ongoing growth of public borrowing and expenditure. Dennis Healey's exploitation of what he called sod off year, the year when he escaped from IMF surveillance, 78-79, inevitably overcame Gerald Barnett's gallant struggle to restrain the recidivist slippage. By contrast, we made clear that somehow or another, and we were not entirely successful, finance must determine expenditure, not expenditure finance. But that objective was, unsurprisingly, in my budget, set within continuance of the monetary framework of counter-inflationary discipline which had been adopted by Dennis Healy at the behest of the IMF. Remarkably, one or two ministerial colleagues claimed to be shocked by this presentation, but other observers were more accurate. The Economist front cover had a headline of which I was proud, "It's what you voted for," and the Daily Mirror headline, "No one who voted Conservative can complain." So we had sold what we were going to do in advance in that election. All of it, of course, was only the first step in a continuing programme of structural change, which had been far too long postponed. The difficulties resulted from this national procrastination were inevitably increased, as we were soon to be reminded, by the fact that this programme was being undertaken at a time of global economic turmoil. But the timing was not of our choosing. Nothing was to be gained by delay. The next highly visible step was my announcement on the 23rd of October 1979 of the abolition of exchange control. This had been stifling financial markets, distorting investment choices for 40 years. It was the only economic decision I've ever taken which kept me awake the night before I announced it. Because when I finally got Margaret Thatcher's agreement to doing so, she said to me rather chillingly, "On your own head be it, Geoffrey, if it goes wrong." When I did make the announcement, Dennis Healy, in his customary friendly fashion, denounced it as reckless and doctrinaire. Enoch Powell envied me, I quote, "the opportunity and the privilege of announcing a step that will strengthen our economy and help restore our national pride." William Keegan of The Observer predicted, predictably, the early reintroduction of controls in the absence of economic miracles. William is still waiting. As has proved to be the case with almost all the strategic decisions that we were to make, such policy reversals were virtually never to be made and haven't been made since, and I leave that for you to contemplate. Michael White's comment in The Guardian was more personal. "Sir Geoffrey," he said, "has come of age. After years in the shadow of Ted and then Margaret, he must now be considered a menace in his own right." My brother was delighted to draw that to my attention. The rest of my time at the Treasury was never to be anything but a roller coaster ride. Only a week later, Chief Secretary John Biffin had to announce our first major public spending review. The next year's total would be no higher than in the current year, which was a substantial position given the rate of inflation then. This meant pruning our predecessors' plans by $3.5 billion, in today's figures, about $9 billion. Then only 2 weeks later came the first of many blows of a different kind, our first major funding crisis. In retrospect, it's become clearer to me than it was at the time that those crises were to do more to influence our week-to-week decision-taking and even our strategic thinking than almost any theoretical analysis. This particular crisis was triggered by publication of the money supply figures for October 1979. Sterling M3 was growing at 14%, well outside our target range. But much more important, in practical terms, than the figure itself, was the consequential fact that the purchasers of government debt were flatly unwilling to finance our borrowing at the then minimum lending rate of 14%. This wasn't seen as astonishing, since inflation was running at an annual rate of 16%, so it was in the United States, where interest rates had recently risen to 18%. Those were the circumstances which we had above all to answer the question, from where, how, and at what price are we to raise the money we have to borrow? Over succeeding months and years, this question time and again recurred. It was bound to do so until we'd secured effective control of our borrowing to that end of expenditure, and of inflation, and thus if we achieved success on both those fronts of monetary growth and interest rates. So in response to my first crisis of that kind, I had no option but to announce an austerity package, an accelerated payment of North Sea oil taxes, and a 3% hike in interest rates to the then unprecedented level of 17%. That was a dramatic illustration of the switchback which had characterized British economic management for many years and still threatened to doing so. It was driving us to examine and re-examine many features. In particular, at this time, the first involved reappraisal of every possible way of measuring and above all controlling monetary growth, including, in the end, twice over actually, monetary-based control. The Prime Minister was recurrently fascinated by that because it looked as though it had a magic potential for delivering lower inflation without requiring higher interest rates. And the result, however, MBC has never, in my time, been adopted in any major economy as the foundation of monetary policy. In truth, at such a time of economic volatility, it was to prove practically impossible to establish with confidence any single monetary indicator as consistently the right one. In 72-74, way back in the Heath era, it was very late in the day when I was having to respond to economic debates in the House very frequently, when I was defending our economic policy. Very late in the day, before I was even briefed to mention such a thing as monetary policy. Eventually, however, in answer to critics who pointed to the alarming growth of M3 from 10% to 28% in 2 years, I was then counselled by the Treasury to focus on M1, whose growth rate had happily fallen over the same period from 16.5 to 7.8. You see the way in which we were having to steer. 10 years later, however, during my time as Chancellor, the monetary roles had been ironically reversed. By then we were praying in aid the broader aggregates, notably sterling M3, which had the intellectual and political advantage of continuity with the IMF Healey era, while our critics were by then citing the narrower bases M0 or M1. No wonder we had our difficulties. But one feature, to me at least, remained clear, and that was the essentially market-based link between the scale of our prospective borrowing and the price we had to pay for it, and the corresponding link between those figures and the resulting rate of inflation. Even if there was no agreement as to exactly how it should be measured, excessive monetary growth appeared to be, indeed was, an inevitable component of those conditions. That was the basis upon which they had evolved, with invaluable input from Nigel Lawson and Terry Burns, whom I'd appointed chief economic advisor at the age of 35, soon after my arrival at the Treasury. They evolved the medium-term financial strategy. That was a central feature of my second 1980 budget speech, which we set out a four-year path for monetary growth, public spending, and tax policies. By 1983-84, the last year covered by our plans, our target rate of monetary growth was to be halved by about 6%. The case for such an approach struck me then, as it does now, as common sense rather than revolutionary. It was a natural follow-through from the sensible IMF lesson that had been absorbed by our predecessors. But I have to say that it doesn't strike me as essentially all that different from the framework of golden rules with which today's Chancellor has sought to maintain economic self-discipline and his own reputation for prudence. And it was the framework of discipline which largely determined the shape of my next 1981 budget, the one which attracted the wrath of the 364 economists who inspired the title of this lecture. It was a budget whose formulation attracted a welter of conflicting expert advice, starting with deep disagreement over monetary policy. On the one hand, we were seriously overshooting our current monetary targets, which we were being pressed to abandon in favour of less severe alternatives. On the other hand, whatever the answer to the monetary dispute, we all wanted to get interest rates down for its own sake and because the pound was by any practical standards too high. If that was to happen, we had to borrow less. Not one of my advisers thought that we could let the 1981-82 public sector borrowing requirement go hang. Absent any change in the tax burden, the outturn was forecast as a PSBR of 6% of GDP. If we were to have any chance of getting back on track for inflation, as well as for interest rates, that had to come down to at least 4% of GDP. The Prime Minister's advisers, but not the Prime Minister herself, had wanted me to go further than that. My final decision was to raise taxes by 4 billion in money of those days. That's double indexation of all excise duties, freezing of all tax thresholds, and increased oil taxation. That at least enabled me, or so we all thought, to secure the 2% reduction in minimum lending rate that I announced to 12%, while still keeping us on track for the sharply reduced inflation rate which Nigel Lawson was eventually to inherit. It was the scale, indeed the very fact, of that tax increase which was the prime affront to the collective wisdom of the 364. Yet in the result, it less than completely served its one essential purpose of enabling us to manage the government's debt in the months ahead. That became apparent from the behaviour of the exchange rate to markets more generally. By mid-August, the pound, 2.37 at the start of the year, had fallen to a four-year low of $1.75. A month later, on the advice of Gordon Richardson, the governor, and very fearful of our ability to fund the PSPR at all, I had to reverse the 2% cut in MLR, which had been almost the only cheerful feature of the 1981 budget. And 2 weeks later, on the eve of the Conservative Party conference, I had to do the same thing again. They were hair-raising times. If we had aimed, in my controversial 1981 budget, for a smaller PSPR, I might well just have got away with the original 2% cut at that time. As it was, the 16% rate which I'd been driven to return to served to restore confidence. Within a few months, it proved possible to bring the bank rate, the base rate, down again. I may be forgiven, I hope, if I quote here again from Edmund Dell. There was little evidence, he says, this is in his book, The Chancellors, little evidence until the 16% MLR that Howe's political, there was little evidence that until the 16% MLR, Howe's political courage in raising taxes in a recession had sufficiently impressed the market. In his budget, he had moved in the right direction, but not far enough. End of quote. That's a verdict which will certainly surprise some of you, but you'll be relieved to hear that's where I intend to draw to a close of this round-by-round review. When I left the Treasury 2 years later, the economy, as I've said, was well into its longest period of growth for many years, with inflation at its lowest since 1968. But unemployment, alas, was still over 3 million and still rising, and it must be said, inevitable. For I am as certain now as I was then that it was absolutely vital in 79-81 to direct policy to defeating inflation. The price was high and deeply regrettable, but inescapable. There was bound to be a cost in slow and at the start even negative growth. I had seen, for example, the fall in numbers employed, and this is just one insight, at the Abbey Steelworks in my hometown of Port Talbot, and from almost 12,000 to just about 5,000, but with the same amount of steel being produced by a much shrunken labour force. That such changes had to be experienced to deal with inflation was a tragedy that did indeed have its roots in the past over many years. But it was only by our willingness, our determination indeed, to make and accept such changes almost throughout the economy, that Britain was able, slowly but eventually, to achieve by 1986 the lowest unemployment rate in Europe. For the last time, let me quote again from Edmund Dell, this time about the 81 budget itself. There is no evidence, he wrote, that a wiser Chancellor could have more sensibly modulated the severity of his action if he was serious in his attack on inflation. And in a wider context, he said, no previous post-war Chancellor had bequeathed to his successor so few problems that would cause anxiety in the marketplace. To put all this finally to a less personal context, let me give one last more comprehensive judgment from another commentator, never perceived as a friend of the Conservative Party, alas, no longer with us, the late Peter Jenkins. He was writing on the 10th anniversary of Margaret Thatcher's arrival in Downing Street on the 4th of May 1989, words which I quoted in No. 10 Downing Street that evening when proposing her health at a celebratory dinner on the same day. History will surely recognise her achievements as Britain's first woman Prime Minister, a leader with the courage of her convictions, who assailed the conventional wisdom of the day, challenged and overthrew the existing order, changed the political map, and put her country on its feet again. If you like, laying the foundations of Thatcher-Blairism, which when Prime Minister Blair was able to welcome his first visiting head of government, Monsieur Chirac, to this country 1997. He took him to Canary Wharf, the site of one of the enterprise zones which I had commented there as a policy in 1978, which had been denounced at that time as a prescription for a capitalist Valhalla. But by the time Mr. Blair came into office, the capitalist Valhalla had become his exhibit of Cool Britannia. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Geoffrey, with that fascinating perspective on the build-up to the 364. We have time for some questions, and I shall throw it open straight away. But I do have my own question, George. You go first. Go ahead, George.
George Jones, ex-LSE. Lord Howe, from the perspective of a Chancellor, what is your assessment of the role of economic advisers and the policy unit at number 10 Downing Street? Was it a help to you or a hindrance?
I think that the existence of any powerfully independent source of advice at number 10, whether it's an economic policy or foreign policy, is bound to make government more difficult. Although if it's properly used, which requires perhaps more patience than is often available, it can improve the quality of government. I think that, for example, when we were having our huge disputes about different ways of managing monetary growth, there was a huge Alan Walters-led critique taking place there, which was being troublesome, although not in any unhappy way. On the other hand, when the time came to shape the 81 budget, the argument between number 10 and ourselves at expert level was carried really to conclusion, which we all at the end thought was about right. I think that I became determined, once I knew of the importance of the number 10 economic unit, to be sure that we were alongside it. And hopefully Peter Middleton went to all the Alan Walters meetings. Alan Walters went to all the Peter Middleton meetings. It didn't continue like that, if I may give an example. By the time I was Foreign Secretary, we were considering our approach to the Madrid summit, when Nigel Lawson and I at that stage suggested a meeting with the Prime Minister. We were denounced for creating a cabalistic conspiracy or something of the kind. So it can be useful, provided it's used in good faith, and it can take quite a lot of time to use it properly.
Yes. Over.
Since none of the economists, or indeed yourself, in the March 1981 budget would have known that the economy was actually on the turn, as you said, in that quarter, Is it perhaps fairer to say that the 364 economists were unlucky rather than wrong?
No. The central point of my thesis is that they were wrong. I mean, the fact that the economy was, as it turned out, just at the bottom at that time, I was unwise enough to say in August, I think, that the recession was over, which is the kind of thing that chancellors ought not to say until they're much more sure than I was then. But the fact is that our policy was being governed at that time by the inescapable need to cover and raise our borrowing. And our failure to actually increase taxes enough made it more difficult to manage that task for the rest of the year. So whatever we'd known about the precise state of the economy, we were being driven by market necessities in covering our borrowing.
Geoffrey, can I ask my own question? Because if looking back over the last 25 years, you can identify a few seminal decisions made by chancellors, and I think probably you're responsible for three of them, which you referred to: your first budget and the big switch from direct to indirect, the ending of exchange controls, and then the 81 budget. This chancellor has been responsible for at least one, the original decision to give the Bank of England independence on monetary policy. You referred very obliquely to that, but was that decision, which I believe I'm right in 97 you supported, although Kenneth Clark did not, was that decision ever discussed in actively at the time that you were Chancellor between 79 and 83? We've heard more recently from Nigel Lawson about his attempts to persuade the Prime Minister of the wisdom of that move, but you didn't refer to that today.
I think that the points that I did make, which were actually canvassed in the Right Approach to the Economy, becoming more open, bringing the governor more up front, was about the limit of what we could get accepted at that time. I didn't think we were pressing for revolutionary change beyond that at that stage. I don't remember discussing it as a serious option. And it is extraordinary that interest rate changes then were regularly a matter for discussion between myself, the governor, and the prime minister. And questions like the date of the next by-election often deemed as important as other monetary considerations. Which is why chancellors like to get it out of number 10.
Yeah. Yes. Could you give your name and designation, please? Thanks.
Sorry.
Could you give your name and
name.
Background?
My name
Thanks.
Is Graham Thomas, and I teach at Reading University. I'd like to ask Lord Howe whether the appalling social consequences of your policies ever occurred to the cabinet of which you were a member.
I think that they manifestly did, because the social consequences were the consequences of the problems with which we're having to deal. The central point in what I was saying is that it was not possible to escape from the endemic inflation on that scale without facing the rise that we did face in unemployment. But it enabled us, with our other policies, in the end, to achieve growth and the ability to tackle social policies as well.
The British economy was in the worst recession since the 1930s.
Well, you have to ask next week's speaker about that.
We will make sure that question is asked. If you're not here, we'll have. Oh, good. Well, in that case, I'll look for you. Thank you. Yes. Down the front here. Sorry, yeah, and then.
Thank you. Alok Basu, ex-LSE. Lord Howe, if I would ask you whether certain aspects of the current Chancellor's policies remind you in any way of the sort of policy framework that you inherited from Labour, do you think that is a reasonable question, given all the criticism we hear about microeconomic interference?
I think that it's dramatically different in the sense that the broad macroeconomic growth is taking place, continuing to do so. The scale of borrowing and prospective overexpenditure hasn't yet begun producing symptoms of the kind that we faced in the late 70s. If I was to criticise the present Chancellor, which I'm not necessarily encouraged to do, I suppose, but the thing that worries me most is his apparent insensitivity to complexity in taxation and legislation. I have, for years now, been campaigning, since before I became a member of the Thatcher government, way back in the 1970s, for a sustained attempt to simplify our tax structure, which means simplifying tax policy as well as tax legislation. I was able, and Nigel was between us, to get rid of a lot of taxes like development land tax, capital transfer tax, investment income surcharge, and make some simplification. I got rid of reduced rate bans and saved 1,400 people employed in the Inland Revenue and many, many more in the private sector. And I think there's a huge scope for doing that, but it requires enormous patience. And much of what the Chancellor has been doing in pursuit very often of legitimate social objectives seems to me to have been moving in the opposite direction. I plead guilty to some tax complications. In my toughest budgets, I introduced bright ideas like the business expansion scheme, the business startup scheme, most of which turned out to be shelters for tax avoidance at a later stage without meeting their purpose, and they complicated the tax system. But I've now been presiding since Ken Clark started it over the Tax Law Rewrite Committee. We are rewriting tax law in simplified language. We're not allowed to simplify the policy. I think that there's nothing more important in the world. An American writer about this said that even in the Garden of Eden, if the serpent had offered either Adam or Eve a tax simplification policy, it would have gone much further than the apple ever did.
Question right up at the top here.
I think its main impact immediately, well, it had two impacts. One, gradually, of course, to provide us with a growing flow of revenue of that kind, as long as it's lasted. Also, to raise the value of the pound awkwardly. One of the reasons for abolishing exchange control was to counter that. It's probably also gave us a period during which it was much harder for traditional manufacturing industries to survive against a high exchange rate and to make the adaptations that were necessary. So, like almost every economic development, some plus, some minus.
Another one at the other end of us.
Norman Bailey, you said at the outset that you were... thanks very much. You said at the outset that you were trying to avoid theological absolutes. Well, surely monetarism is a theological absolute, or was. And to remind you that you did abandon the medium-term financial strategy in 85 and therefore bringing into question the whole theology of monetarism. And the second point I'd like to mention is you did describe the situation in the economy at the end of your period as being characterized by success in terms of long-term growth and so on, but you didn't really stress the recession of 79-81, 3 million people unemployed, and the following recession, 91-92, a massive decline in output and national income, and again, 3 million people unemployed.
Well, I will address that, if I may, because I think, address and acknowledge the unemployment during my time at the Treasury as being inescapable. It was a consequence of having to get inflation under control. And the absence of it as we went through the 1980s was an achievement of success in that direction. For me, the sadness is, and I say this in my own memoirs, that by the end of the 1980s, we had begun to believe, over-believe, in our own success. At that time, I was Foreign Secretary, and I say in my book that I remember making speeches at that time around the world, which made it sound as though we'd learned to walk upon the water, and we became overconfident. That's one of the hazards, and it's one of the hazards that the present Chancellor may face, because as some of his cabinet colleagues have said, if he goes on proclaiming as often and as loudly as he does the scale of his economic success, he might begin to believe it himself and land himself in the same problem. So I acknowledge the difficulty about that, but I'd like to address much more directly your discussion of monetarism and theology. Now, throughout my speech, I try to emphasize that I am not a theologian, I'm not an absolutist. And I think that those who proclaim either monetarism or Keynesianism as isms to which you have to believe are profoundly misguided. I think that those who've helped us to understand the importance of monetary policy as a component in economic planning have played an invaluable part, and it seems to me to be an inescapable part. One of the people whom I admired very greatly during our years in opposition was Gordon Pepper, one of the most regular commentators on the monetary aspect of economic policy. And he taught us to recognize it as important. In the Heath government, it was never mentioned in all the debates about prices and incomes policy. Nobody ever raised it until almost the end, and it was essential to bring it in. Now, Gordon Pepper has written an interesting book since then with Michael Salmon, which I've just got some quotations from here, because it's entitled Monetarism Under Thatcher, Lessons for the Future. And he there does really try to analyze it in almost theological terms, because he categorizes monetarists by degrees of belief in monetarism. Dennis Healy, in a way, started that by talking about pseudo-monetarism, because he, quote, practiced monetarism. He introduced economic policy and economic monetary management into his mix, and that was right to do so. To denounce pseudo-monetarism was to use a quasi-religious device to denounce other people's management of the same device into sheep and goats. He says Dennis Healy and Douglas Watt were self-confessed skeptical monetarists. He describes Peter Middleton, Nigel Lawson and myself, rather remarkably, as political monetarists. He describes Terry Burns, incomprehensibly, as an international monetarist. And the only true believers in monetarism in Gordon Pepper's analysis are Margaret Thatcher and Keith Joseph, who were, of course, the two who were furthest from the coalface. Now, I do not believe in monetarism. I'm not required to believe in economic doctrines. They're not a religion. I attach great importance to the importance of monetary policy. I attach great importance to the learning of Keynes. But they have to be married together and judged. That's why I commended my experience as an assessor of expert witnesses. And by God, economic experts are as difficult as any.
There was another right at the back there. Yeah.
Paul Davis, present LSE. I wanted to change the topic slightly to labour market policy, which you briefly mentioned in terms of step-by-step reform of British labour market and labour law in the 80s, which I took to be a reference back and contrast to the Big Bang approach of the reform of the Industrial Relations Act. And I wondered if there were other ways in which, in labour market reform, you learn from the failure of the Industrial Relations Act in which you were intimately involved.
Right, I don't, you see, accept the failure of the Industrial Relations Act. I think that had we been a shade luckier in the 74 election, the Industrial Relations Act would have survived with very little change. I think we were taking a high-risk policy, but in a way we'd been invited to do so by the breadth of the agenda that Barbara Castle produced in a place of strife. And during those late 60s, Stephen Abbott and I, he was then in the research department, alas no longer with us, and Robert Carr as the shadow minister in charge, we studied the whole of the experience, not just of the United States, but of Canada, Ontario, other Commonwealth jurisdictions, and produced in the Industrial Relations Bill what was a comprehensive and well-considered package. But we were undertaking what the United States had undertaken in the Norris-LaGuardia Act in 1932, Taft-Hartley in the 1940s, and Landrum-Griffin in the 1950s. And it was a huge mouthful. But had we not lost the 74 election, which we lost because of the prices and the incomes policy, we would have been able to maintain the Industrial Relations Act. We should have saved a decade in terms of transformation of our labour market. Having been through that mill, I agree that we did then follow, as I said in my speech, a much more step-by-step approach in the 1980s. We might have been wiser to do that in the 1970s. I think we could have got away with it, although it may have been a high-risk policy when we started.
I've got three more people who've caught my eye. We'll take those three and then see how we are for time. One here, pink shirt, blue and yellow tie, which in many environments would invalidate you from asking a question, but we're a broad church here, so...
Matthew Hancock from the Bank of England. I wanted to ask you a question about Paul Volcker's approach to monetarism. He argued that he brought in monetarism in order to allow him to raise interest rates, which is what he wanted to do in the first place, and that he couldn't persuade the FOMC to raise interest rates per se. So he brought in a monetary target and put it in front of them and said, there you go, we need to raise interest rates to meet this. Does that that sort of analysis fit into how you approach monetarism, in that because the targets were being missed and you wanted to get inflation under control, that gave you the ability to explain a rise in interest rates?
No, you persist, you say, in talking about monetarism. I repudiate absolutely this concept of a package called monetarism. You have a more sophisticated discussion of it, I think, in the monthly bulletins, or more or less monthly bulletins, that come from Lombard Street Research. And in the last two that Tim Congdon's edited, there's a much more balanced assessment of the consequences in terms of thinking of a Keynesian approach, if you take it too far, in terms of being automatically linked with incomes policy. I don't believe that, but it's the sort of balance of arguments you can have. I think that I haven't discussed with Paul Volcker why he moved in that direction when he did, but merely to introduce the need to focus on monetary aggregates as a component of economic planning isn't to adopt a theology. It's to adopt a new aspect of economic measurement and be guided by that as well as others. Do please repudiate. I'm speaking as a Welshman whose grandfather founded two Welsh-speaking Calvinistic Methodist chapels. And I'm full of religious fervour. You economists shouldn't have this kind of religious fervour about you. Reason, please.
Woman at the back, and then right the pillar.
Linda Bainton, head teacher. I was just wondering, Lord Howe, if perhaps the government and the Treasury, if they had spent more money on an education system that respected intelligence where you got your hands dirty, and spent money on leadership skills for management that brought out the best in their workers, we may actually have more of a manufacturing base today.
Well, that's a rather different question posed by a head teacher. It's very difficult to answer. I think that, of course, education is of fundamental importance, and I'm going to get into a huge debate about what way that ought to be changed, whether you need extra resources or not. I don't think I can make a link quite as attractive as you do. I could begin discussing the financing of university education, but that would be to start an entirely different debate. I merely invite you, those of you that are interested in this, to study the weekly coloured magazine that comes from China, English language magazine, called the Beijing Review, which discusses the reforms currently being made in the essentially loan-based, fee-based structure of Chinese university education, discussing adjustments in the student loans, describing how they need to have their repayment rates determined by the market assessment of appropriate interest rates, to reflect upon the fact that the two countries that have now got probably the most lively university structures in the world, the United States and the People's Republic of China, are those that are furthest away from the ideology that drives the opposition to student fees. That's just by way of footnote.
Andreas Weisman, New Boathouse Capital, private sector. I wondered whether you thought that in some sense, and I stress in some sense, the economic and social crisis in which Britain found itself in 1979 was the inevitable consequence of Britain's attempt after the war, initiated by the Attlee government, to heal the wounds of the Depression and the war. And to the extent that you don't believe that, what element in your view of policies undertaken after the war was mainly responsible for this crisis, which other European countries that equally followed economic and social policies based on some social consensus with the union or labor movement caused British approach of handling these issues to fail when they did not do so in some countries in the continent?
Gosh, I don't really think I can tackle that. It's too comprehensive a question. I could sort of find examples. I think you'd have to go back and read books like The Audit of War and The Verdict of Peace, the Kareli Barnett books, to begin to assess the answer to that. One could cite particular examples. I think, for example, the comprehensive public ownership of the National Health Service, rather than the adoption of the 1944 White Paper, which would have left a much more diverse, diffuse structure of the health service, would have been a better approach. I think that in retrospect, the plague of public ownership landed us in a whole range of fool's paradises. It's fascinating that one of the huge burdens that I faced in the Treasury was the wholly unpredictable impact of nationalized industry deficits. They were out with one's control. One found oneself facing £1 billion bill for coal, £500 million for steel. And one of the great advantages of liberation in that respect has been to take those chunks off the Chancellor's table. And again, it's significant that there's been no proposal for reversal of any of those changes. That, I think, is the really fascinating thing about the history of the last 7 years. When Tony Blair secured the removal of Clause 4, when one saw the tone and style of the incoming Labour government manifesto in 97, I went to the United States 2 days after the election, not because of it, but I was due to go there anyway. And I was interviewed by a number of American newspapers, and the headline on my entry was always "Top Tory Unfazed by Labour Win." So I thought that the impact of Thatcherism on the Labour Party had been sufficiently positive to ensure a broadly common ground agenda for the years that followed. And I said in the same interviews that all my life until then, I'd spent my life terrified that Labour spokesmen might mean what they were saying. My only fear from then on was that they might not mean what they were saying.
Geoffrey, our principal objective in running this series of lectures this term has been to explore some of the context and the background against which economic policy in this country is formulated and has been in the past and is in the future. And my own view, and I was pleased that in one of your answers to questions you referred to this, there is a great danger in the rhetoric which suggests that somehow we have abolished boom and bust, we have abolished the business cycle, we have now produced the complete answer to sound economic management. We are having a good run. There's no doubt about that. But I think it's very valuable to look back, and particularly to look back with people who were in the driving seat at the time, at the experience of the last 35 years of the UK economy, because many of the issues do remain below the surface and remain important today. The issues of public spending and the nature of funding, government deficit, etc. We couldn't have had, I think, a more authoritative and fascinating review of a crucial turning point in British economic policy. It's obvious in this room that there are still those who wonder, and that's perhaps inevitable, about the nature of that turning point and whether it could have been, the corner could have been turned in a slightly different way. But we certainly can't deny that we've had a fascinating first-hand glimpse of why the decisions were made in the way they were, how they were made, the background to them was, and that's been exactly what we had in mind in promoting this series. So we're enormously grateful to you for all the work you clearly put into this. I hope your enforced trip down memory lane was not too painful, and that you perhaps, and I sensed as I listened, that you perhaps enjoyed rehearsing some of these things, but we certainly are very grateful to the effort you put into this, and thank you so much for coming.
thank you very much for the invitation and for the reception. I look forward to the fulfillment of one condition. Those of us who have been tempted not once but twice to give these talks here find them a fascinating challenge. But one of the almost conditions precedent was that they would be published. I do hope that can be achieved because one likes to see what the other guys have said.